Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's a great American art form read by millions every day, and the best of it rises to the level of literature. It balances the urgency of news with the precision of poetry. A celebration of the American newspaper column this hour of the program with the editor of Deadline Artists, America's greatest newspaper columns. John Avlon is with us, and John is a senior columnist for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, as well as a CNN contributor. He's the author of Independent Nation, How Centrists Can Change American Politics, and Wingnuts, How the Lunatic Fringe is Hijacking America, as well as being a columnist and associate editor. He was for the New York Sun, and he was chief speechwriter for New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani. He, after the attacks of September 11, was responsible for writing the eulogies of all firefighters and police officers murdered in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And his essay on the attacks, The Resilient City, concluded the anthology Empire City, New York Through the Centuries, and won acclaim as the single best essay written in the wake of 9/11. John is with us as we remember some who are no longer with us and some who are still with us, and look at the history of, I love newspaper columns. I don't know about you, but there are certain columnists that before I even read the news, I go to the columnist, particularly on Sundays, go right to the column. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure that you have some favorite columnists. The book brings together columns from all papers all over America, writers like Mike Royko and Herb Kane, Jimmy Breslin, Marie Kempton, Ernie Pyle, Peggy Noonan, Thomas Friedman, Ernest Hemingway, Benjamin Franklin, Eleanor Roosevelt, Art Buchwald, Hunter S. Thompson, and many others. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, John. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And what a great idea for a book, and what a lovely book. It is like reading history and poetry at the same time. When these people are on, they are really good.
They really are, and it makes you realize that they are artists, and it's a it's a creative high wire act writing columns on Deadline like this. And one, as a columnist, I can appreciate the improvisational feat of it. But when you realize how good it can be, that these guys were not only writing reported columns, they were great storytellers, and they thought about that when they were writing it, especially the folks who were writing before TV, the way that they were doing vivid descriptive writing to have these characters and scenes come alive in the mind's eye. And you could see some of them influenced by Hemingway and other great writers. And in fact, Hemingway's in the book when he was a newspaper writer. It just opens up a world of possibilities, and it's a joy to read.
Yeah. And when you were just saying that, the guy who immediately came to mind was Ernie Pyle.
Yeah. Ernie Pyle is one of the great American newspaper columnists, and he's sort of the patron saint of most newspaper columnists. Mm. The National Society of Newspaper Columnists ran a contest in conjunction with the release of the book where their members voted on the greatest newspaper column of all time. And Ernie Pyle's column, The Death of Captain Waskow, narrowly beat out Yes, Virginia, There Is a Santa Claus.
Oh, really?
Which is probably better known. But you read it, and it does read like a short story. And indeed, many of the best of these do read like a short story, but it's absolutely true. And it has the virtue of being, it's history written in the present tense. And there's something so thrilling about that and so transcendently true. And Ernie Pyle was known as the GI journalist. He traveled with the GIs on the front lines through World War II. He wrote for a mass audience. He didn't do highbrow stuff. He wrote from the perspective of the soldier. And in fact, he lost his life in combat 1 year after he won the Pulitzer Prize. He is beloved and remembered, and someone should do a biopic on Ernie Pyle real quick.
Yeah, there you go. You should.
There you go.
Yeah, you should. Well, the other thing is that he brings, what a huge task it is to bring the war experience home to people who don't serve in war. And he does it just about as well as anybody.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's one of the real challenges is what is the role of a columnist, especially in combat? You know, I had my experiences during 9/11 I was working in government at the time, but reading the columnists who were writing that day, you know, there's the responsibility of a columnist is different than a reporter. It's not simply to record facts. It's to try to get to a deeper truth and to cut through that fog of war, which is a cliched phrase to some extent, but it's cliched because it's absolutely true. There's simply no way to comprehensively know what's going on in those moments. And for a columnist to try to be in the moment but also take a step back, to cut through the fog of war and to try to tell the truth about something as compelling and violent and chaotic as combat, that is incredibly difficult. And what we did with the war section of the book, where Ernie Pyle is, as we did with the other sections, politics, humor, sports, crime, is to try to also, within each section, organize it chronologically so you could trace the history of the country. We began with Richard Harding Davis, who writes about the German troops marching into Brussels at the outset of World War I. Richard Harding Davis being an inspiration to Ernest Hemingway and sort of this sort of Indiana Jones-type figure. He was this globe-trotting columnist, pioneering war correspondent, helped create the legend of Teddy Roosevelt at San Juan Hill. And then you went through World War II with Ernie Pyle, but not just Ernie Pyle, incredible columns that chronicle that experience. And then Vietnam, people like Pete Hamill, who's known in other areas,
but
his writing in Vietnam is amazing. And then we paired that with Art Hoppe, who writes a heartbreaking column called To Root Against Your Own Country, where he realizes that the Vietnam War has become so divisive at home that one day he, a member of the World War II generation, unconsciously caught himself rooting against our troops and was horrified by that and reflected on what that means, and then did it through the present day. And some great columnists writing today, Nick Kristof of the New York Times, puts himself on the front
marvelous,
lines. He keeps that
marvelous
Ernie Pyle tradition alive.
Yeah, he sure does. I was amazed how many of these I read, and they literally made me cry because they brought back times in history that were very, very difficult. And they were done with such great beauty. It's as though we asked the columnist to put in our hearts those moments so that it's not just writing about what happened. It's talking about, and I'm thinking of Jimmy Breslin, profile of JFK's gravedigger, and some of the other columns that were, and Eugene Robinson's column about the election of Obama and what it meant to African Americans. I mean, you can't read these without crying, really.
I'm really happy you said that. Not because I take pleasure in the thought of you crying, but but because they are emotional. I mean, the column that does it for me is Molly Ivins, a short story about the Vietnam Memorial Wall.
Yes,
where she
yes.
writes. She tells the story about the Vietnam Wall. She really tells the story of a generation, and she writes it in third person from the perspective of a middle-aged woman going to see the wall to find the name of her former graduate school boyfriend.
Yeah.
And tells the story of their relationship, and it's mostly about their relationship. And it is a beautiful piece of work. It reads like a Raymond Carver short story, but more sentimental. And and the best of these columns do communicate that emotion, because at the end of the day, this is the piece in the part of the newspaper that's set aside for something true. It's set aside to remind us what really matters. And there are too few places in our civic debate that do that. And at the best, the columnists do. At the worst, it's just part of the noise of the crowd. At its best, it's a beacon.
I was amazed, John, that there had not been compilations of this great literature before. You write in the intro that this was the book that you wanted to read as a young journalist for inspiration, for education, for entertainment. So you couldn't find one, so you put this together.
That is my philosophy on how one should approach writing books. it is... I think this is the core idea. If anyone out there is thinking about writing a book, I think this is the measure that will help. It means that your soul will guide you, and it also means that there's a need for it, that you should write the book that you want to read. And there'll be an integrity in that process. This obviously isn't writing a book. This was anthologizing a book, and it's a lot easier, frankly, than writing a book. But there's the own weight of history on it, too, because I wanted to make sure that we were getting it right, and there was so much that we could not know. You know, given the fact that myself and my two colleagues who did this, Errol Lewis and Jesse Angelo, we're all, you know, relatively young. And so we can ask, we can inquire, we can do our best, but you know you're not. We saw this at the beginning of a conversation. We knew there was no way it could actually be definitive, but we did the best we could. But that approach to writing a book, or writing anything, I think hopefully leads a degree of integrity to any project, and it means there's a need for it. And we were amazed that this book didn't exist. You know, I'll tell you a little bit about how I came to it. I'd previously worked as a speechwriter, and being a speechwriter and a columnist have at least one thing in common, which is that there's no school you go to study for it. When you become a speechwriter, and I was a speechwriter at a very young age for, you know, Rudy Giuliani, they invariably you end up being given a book called Lend Me Your Ears, which was compiled by former Nixon speechwriter and longtime New York Times columnist William Safire.
Another great columnist.
A great columnist, and has a book. We have one of his columns in the book called Word of the Year Freedom for 1989. It's just a great column. And it captures that enthusiasm in that year. It is a compilation of the great speeches throughout time. And you read it as a young speechwriter to get a sense of the best of the past. What are the forms? What leads work? You know you can't reach it, but it gives you a sense of the contours of the ballpark you're playing in. And so, naturally, I looked for a similar book when I became a newspaper columnist, and there wasn't any. And so there were plenty of anthologies of individual columnists' greatest work, and there were some that did snapshots of pieces. Carl Meyer had a book called Pundits, Poets, Wits, and Sages. But there wasn't a comprehensive book that organized thematically that really seemed to bring together the columns that we were referred to by our older colleagues, guys like Jack Newfield, who Errol Lewis and I had the pleasure of working with before he died. And he was just one of the legendary local New York columnists, friends of Muhammad Ali and Bobby Kennedy. And he helped, you know, inform a lot of this book and inspire a lot of this book. So it really was a process of interviewing older columnists and saying, what are the columns you remember? What do you love? And the book took shape.
That is the column that I read yesterday. Was it... who wrote the column on Muhammad Ali about all he signified?
Newfield.
It was Jack Newfield. That's a great column.
Yeah,
that's a great column.
Jack was just great. He was part of that classic generation of columnists who came of age in the 60s and 70s who were themselves informed. It was you know, you were talking to a lineage because they remember the heyday of the columnists, the 20s and 30s, 40s and 50s. And you got a sense of what that newspaper culture was like, especially in New York. It wasn't just in New York. You know, obviously, Chicago has a great newspaper culture. All cities have them.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something special about Jack's connection to the past, and you lost something. I mean, and that's part of the point of the book is that, you know, right now we are living in a time where people are writing obituaries for newspapers every day. But opinion writing is proliferating like never before online. The problem is that, you know, the Internet, you know, can sometimes create the illusion that history basically began around 1996. You know, there's a limit to how much is archived of the past that's readily available. And as a result, you know, a lot of these columns, most of the columns in this book, are not available online. I remember just this year when I was putting the book together, it was the anniversary of John Lennon's assassination. And I wanted to do a link to one of my favorite columns in the book, Jimmy Breslin's Are You John Lennon?
Yes.
Which he wrote in 3 hours and interviewed the cop who carried John Lennon's body from the Dakota to the hospital. And it's a beautiful piece of work. It's really it perfectly captures what I mean by deadline artist. The Daily News didn't have it online. Jimmy Breslin, who's still alive, didn't have a copy that was digital. So, that sort of illustrates the need and the opportunity for this, let alone columns like The Death of Frankie Jerome, which was the column that started this whole process that hadn't been anthologized since 1924.
Which is a knockout column. Oh, my gosh. And a number of people said that's the best column ever written when you asked the people who write columns who's the best.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. They mentioned that one in particular. And these are folks who are largely forgotten today, Westbrook Pegler and Hayward Bruhn, who were hugely influential in the 1930s in particular, and had dueling sensibilities. And Pegler, they could write, you know, the best of the columnists can write in any genre. You know, that's the thing you see. And you see it up to people like Molly Ivins and Pete Dexter in recent history. You know, they can write about sports, they can write about humor, they can write about politics, they can write about war. They're incredibly skillful. They can hit any pitch.
Mm-hmm.
But Pegler, who went crazy later in life, so his reputation was a bit dimmed by that, and Hayward Bruhn, who was his opposite, more on the liberal side of the aisle, these guys, they could just write like angels. And You know, so you're discovering these whole undiscovered countries when you discover their work. And my hope is that it will lead to a restoration of their reputations, and some of their great books will be back in print.
Yeah. I remember interviewing Jimmy Breslin, years and years and years ago, in which he was talking about, and I hear him in my head right now because he spoke beautifully, too. I'll have to interview him again. And he was talking about jobs and the importance of work to everybody. And I got to tell you, it was poetic. Every time I ask or I think about, and now it's front and center, jobs, I think about Jimmy Breslin and his description of how important work is to human beings, John. He stayed with me all these years later.
Well, that's what a great columnist does, right? It's amazing to me that these columns, you know, we use the phrase in the introduction, you know, beloved but half remembered. And that's what many of these columns are. I emailed Christopher Hitchens, who writes magazine columns. So we were focusing on newspaper columns because we had to narrow the focus somewhat. But I asked him, you know, what are your favorite newspaper columns? And he's battling a serious illness,
yes.
But still emails when he can. And he remembered this column. He said, I'm juggling a lot right now, but it's just off the cuff. I remember a column that Russell Baker wrote in the 80s about Groundhog Day that made me laugh. That's all we had. We went out and found
I remember that column.
Yeah. And so that's sort of the way this happens. You know, these are beloved but half remembered. It's amazing. You know, Peggy Noonan referred, she said, you know, I remember George Will wrote a column about his son who has Down syndrome. And when we emailed George Will, it was fascinating. He selected as his favorite columns, not columns about politics, but columns about his family. And George Will, let me tell you, when he puts his mind to it, he is a beautiful writer.
Yes, he is. What's the one that it's toward the back of the book I was reading last night from George Will?
It was either John Will's Aptitudes, which is about his son with Down syndrome, who basically the point of the column was no one should feel sorry for him. He's very happy. And he is an affirmation of life for me and for those who know him. It's an incredibly powerful column, it is a testament of love. And also a column about his mother's passing.
That's what it was, his mother's passing. That's a knockout column.
It's about, she'd been suffering from, I believe, Alzheimer's and dementia for a time, and it was about her slow fade and about her life. And it is at a time, that's sort of why the other reason I wrote this book. You know, one of the things I think columns do for people is it gives them something to hang on to in tough times. It's not asking someone to read a 400-page novel to discover the meaning of life. It's 800 words. It's 1,000 words.
Mm-hmm.
But I
mm-hmm.
had a friend who was anticipating her mother's death after a long illness, and she was working on the eulogy and just got stuck. And then I said, here, read this. This might help you. And it helped. It gave her so much comfort and perspective that she was able to follow through and write that. And that's what these columns do. They give you comfort. They give you courage. They give you perspective. And that's, I think, what great art does at the end of the day. They remind us. It reminds us that we're not alone.
Exactly.
And that's a real transcendent importance.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. John Avlon is our guest. He is one of the editors of a wonderful book. If you like newspaper columns, get this one. If you want to learn history and opinion and poetry and beauty in the spoken word, and this just isn't recent. Some of these columns go way back to some of the great columnists. There are columns from Ernest Hemingway, from Eleanor Roosevelt, from some of our founding fathers, who, of course, used the column for political reasons. And, a lot of people use columns for political reasons. It's separated by areas, and it's just a treasure of all kinds of wonderful columns. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Mitch in Franklin. Hi, Mitch.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call. I had a couple of quick questions. One was about the editorial process on how certain newspapers choose their columnists, because as the guest had pointed out, you know, there's a lot of what's assumed just to be opinion in many columns, and it is 90% noise, especially if you disagree with it. Then as much as it's good to get the perspective, it's kind of irritating, and it may kind of skew your view of the newspaper itself as making that choice. And then just secondarily to that, I guess so many columns now are kind of bundled on the internet just because so few people actually read physical newspapers. Like, there's a tendency I find in myself just to go to the websites that I like in order to find the columnists that I like. Like, you know, as a lefty, go to the Daily Kos because you're going to find a, you know, generally agreeable columnist. It's something lost when that happens, when you don't just, because you want to read, happen to read a column that you don't necessarily agree with. And I'll take my answers off the air.
Thanks, Mitch. Thanks for the call.
I think the caller makes a great point. You know, we are too often, one of the things that the impact that the internet has had on column writing is it has become much more opinion writing and along partisan lines. We've seen the rise of partisan media in the last several decades, and in part in the last two decades, really. It's a resurgence of an old problem in American politics. Newspapers used to be essentially run by political parties. But it does, you know, the process, which is called cocooning in industry terms, does lead to, I think, a degradation of our civic debate. If you read the best of these columnists, Peggy Noonan and Molly Ivins on the right and left, respectively, they're a joy to read no matter what your politics are, because it's the elegance of a well-formed argument. It's great writing. It helps you learn a little bit about the other perspective. And in the political section of the book, we took great care to make sure that all sides were represented. You know, we have William F. Buckley and Dan Henninger from the Wall Street Journal. But we also have Hayward Bruin and Molly Ivins and many others. So we were very conscious about trying to make sure that a full spectrum of political debate was represented, because at its best, you know, life in a democracy is a never-ending debate, and left, right, and center, especially center from my perspective, should be represented. But when people only go for opinions that reaffirm their own political prejudices, you're not engaging in a civic debate, not a real one. You're looking for reaffirmation. You're looking to harden your own position, and you're eating a steady diet that ultimately hardens your positions and degrades our ability to have a really constructive civic debate. That's what's happening too often in politics now. That is a symbol of a bad column to me. And it's a terribly ironic reaction to the proliferation of opinion online. Instead of really drinking deeply of different perspectives, too often what we have is people just seeking things that confirmed their own prejudices and political biases. And we end up self-segregating ourselves into separate political realities. That's a problem that has to do with politics more than column writing per se, but it's bled over, and the caller is exactly right to call it out.
Let's talk about the style of, and I'm wondering if there's anybody comparable. I think there was in her day, but I'm thinking of, in the politics section, Mary McGrory on McCarthy, and the column is just kind of a straightforward thing. It's titled "Welch Defends One Friend and Finds He's Made Many." How would you describe her style? And am I right here that there were others who just sort of wrote this ironic, straightforward, you got the point?
Well, Mary McGrory is really one of the great columnists as well. And you know, if we do a volume two, and there's some interest in it, and folks who are out there who are interested in the book, obviously not only buy it, but feel to go onto our Facebook page at Deadline Artists, or email us through the website deadlineartists.com, and email your suggestions of what should be in a volume two, because we really want to have that kind of a conversation. But Mary McGrory is one of these columnists who was an iconic figure, and could have been in the book in any number of different sections. We ended up choosing two columns from her, the column you refer to where she confronts the Army-McCarthy hearings. And in that case, what I love is you get that same-day sense of that famous quote, which is, you know, "Have you no sense of decency,
right,
sir, at long last? Have you no sense of decency?" That ultimately derailed the whole McCarthyite momentum and fever. That confrontation is what broke the fever. And here you have, again, history written in the present tense. You see Mary McGrory writing beautifully about that lonely stand
and how it shifted the whole debate, but she's doing it that day.
Right, right.
And that's the, you know, what a great columnist and reporter does is has that incisive ability to cut through the noise, to realize what's really important. Out of those thousands and thousands and thousands of words that were said that day, mm-hmm. what really matters? What distills it? And we also have her writing on JFK's funeral called A Day of Endless Fitness. But she was part of this, and she inspired a future generation that included Maureen Dowd.
Mm-hmm.
This is a classic Washington columnist, and her work on Watergate won her a Pulitzer. She just is one of these figures who keeps that dogged search for the truth with an impish sense of humor.
Yes.
I think it's probably
a good
way to
put
it.
That's a good way to put it. Let's go to Frank in Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Frank.
Another superb guest. Great topic.
Thanks.
Could I ask the guest what his opinion is of those who move perhaps from neutral punditry towards satire? You have sort of great pieces like The Defense of Women from Mencken and Molly Ivins' really affectionate dissection of W.
I don't know how affectionate that dissection was. But.
And there's the contrast with those who are fully engaged, very serious, David Frum and Christopher Hitchens.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Frank, I appreciate the call. I mean, look, I think Frum and Hitchens are two of the very best columnists of our recent era. But, I mean, Hitchens clearly uses humor a great deal and satire in his writing. Now, when he gets really angry, he doesn't. But that's a hallmark of his style. You can see the influence of Mencken running through him, as well as, you know, because of his Brit roots. You can see stylistic, not echoes, but you can tell that he and his friend Martin Amis came from the same pond, so to speak. And you know, probably a little bit of Philip Larkin thrown in there too. But David Frum, who I agree with, and you know, politically a great deal and admire a lot, he writes an incredibly elegant column. But you're right, the folks who use satire, I think it's an underutilized weapon, and here's a fascinating fact. You know, when we went back and looked at the history of the column, the newspaper column as we know it today evolved slowly in fits and starts. Our book goes back to Ben Franklin writing in Poor Richard's Almanac, where he comes up with these great American aphorisms, which you realize become basically, they are the basis of American folkism, full stop. People like Ambrose Bierce and Mark Twain. But around the late 19th, early 20th century, as the column is taking form, the newspaper column as we know it really was primarily a humor column. It was a humor column because it was seen as an antidote, in effect, to the seriousness of the editorials that a newspaper would publish. So there'd be the serious editorials on this side, and then next to them the columns, which were a lighter touch. So actually, it was something that was much more widespread, and I think we have seen the decline of the humor column in recent years. And I think it's greatly to our detriment, because we could all use a little bit of sense of humor. And one of the things a sense of humor requires when you're talking about civic debates isn't just that sort of scalpel, you know, rapier wit. It requires a sense of perspective, which we could all use when we talk about our politics, and we've lost a little bit today. So I think it's really underutilized. It's a great American tradition, and I'd love to see a resurgence of it. I mean, The Onion, which originally based out of Wisconsin, does some of the most incisive political commentary using humor, and it does it, you know, very often in headlines. I think that, you know, the Onion in some ways keeps up that tradition, but it evolves it to a different form. I'd like to see it be brought back to columns as well.
Just because we're in the midst of baseball, the World Series, and football, and we're doing very well in Wisconsin, I shouldn't say this, but I will. I'm not a huge football fan. I love baseball, but I have problems in my...
I'm with you, but don't tell anyone.
Are you?
Yeah.
I love this column, and I'm going to use it all the time. I guess I missed reading this, or maybe I read it years ago. Why is baseball so much better than football?
Tom Boswell.
This was a great column. I'm gonna use facts from this all the time for
Read
the rest of my life.
It's a fun one.
Face masks. Right away, we've got a clue something might be wrong. A guy can go 80 miles an hour in a Harley without a helmet, much less a face mask. Faces are better than helmets. Think of all the players in the NFL whom you'd recognize on the street. Now eliminate the quarterbacks. Not many left, are there? Think of all the baseball players whose faces you know just from the last series.
Yeah. It's Tom Boswell. One of the great things I remember, I found out about that column. He was interviewed for the great, epically wonderful, if people haven't seen it, they should, Ken Burns documentary, Baseball. And he was being interviewed about that column in that documentary. And he said that he sat down to write it, and he was done before lunch. 99 reasons that baseball is better than football.
Yeah, it's a good one. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I'm glad you're on the topic of humor, because one of my favorite columnists is Art Buchwald, and in particular, a column he wrote fairly late in life, at near the end of the Bush administration. The president had proposed a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage, and he wrote this Congress All It Ever Thinks About Is Sex column, in which he delivers one-liners that are just hilarious, that he's with the spokesman for the administration, and the spokesman asserts Congress has the authority to declare who can be in love and who can't. That's what our forefathers said they wanted. Thomas Jefferson vowed he wouldn't cohabit with Benjamin Franklin, and Abigail Adams never wrote a mash note to Martha Washington. And he ends the column with quoting Abraham Lincoln supposedly being against gay marriage, where George W. Bush has mangled the "you can fool some of the people, some of the time" quote in a press conference, and Buchwald wrote, "Don't you remember Lincoln saying you can fool some of the homosexuals some of the time and all of the heterosexuals some of the time, but you cannot fool all of the men and the women all of the time?" It's hilarious, and it captures the a generational shift, actually, although Buchwald was very old at this time. So I'll buy the book if you have Art Buchwald in it somewhere. It doesn't have
I
to
do.
Be this column,
we have two Art Buchwald columns. But I just wrote down, I sent an email to myself about what you just mentioned, because if we do a volume two, we'll include that one. We've got, Buchwald is great, and Buchwald was really a jump ball, whether we'd include him in politics or humor. But he's got a great column, well, two great columns that we include in the book. One, Nixon Goes to the Mountaintop, where God interviews Richard Nixon at the beginning of Watergate. And it's one of these great sort of conceits you see every once in a while, which is a president or a political figure talking to God. And it's absolutely hilarious, where God's giving him advice on, you know, Nixon feels persecuted because of the pressure of Watergate, and is asking God, why me? It's sort of a Jobian struggle, and asking for advice on what to do. And it's great. I mean, Buchwald really talk about that tradition of satire, but deep down telling the truth. He could do that. The other one that is honestly should be required reading, or at least a cautionary tale, imagines what it would be like if pollsters did a poll at the beginning of the American Revolution. And he runs through it, and he basically makes fun of the absurdity of, he basically said, you know, we never would have gotten off the ground. I'll pull it up right now. He basically makes the argument that, here, I just absolutely love this. Do you think that Patrick Henry did the right thing in demanding liberty or death? Did a foolhardy thing and was a troublemaker, 53%. Did a brave thing and made his point, 23%. Should have gone through the court, 6%. Don't know, 8%. And he goes through all these questions and concludes, on the basis of the results of the poll, the militant colonials decided they did not have enough popular support to format a revolution and gave up on the idea of creating a United States of America.
Oh, bunch of love minds like that. Thank you, Rich, very much for the call. It's amazing to me how people can, I think it was Leonard Pitts in his September 12, 2001 column wrote, and this must be true of everybody who's in this book, it's my job to have something to say. And you've got to say something about an event like September 11th when nobody knew exactly what to say or what the heck hit us. What a job. It's a difficult job to be a columnist and write something pertinent and important that matters when you have an event like that.
Sure. I mean, well, first of all, just a reality check. It's a tough job to the extent that you want to find a way to cut through the fog and to tell the truth as you see it and to do it on demand. But it's not like working in a salt mine, all right? It's actually an honor to be able to do it. But Leonard Pitts' column in particular is remarkable because we have a number of 9/11 columns in there. Leonard Pitts and Pete Hamill both writing the day of. And Peggy Noonan in the section called Hard Times writing a beautiful column, which is one of my favorites, called His Delicious Mansard-Roofed World, which is all about the way that the attacks have reawoken America to what's important and maybe rekindled a sense of spirituality and deeper purpose. But Leonard Pitt's column is written literally in the hour after, and it is barely restrained rage, and it captures that spirit so much so that it ended up being read aloud, I believe, in the floor of the Capitol. And in those relatively early days, the Internet got 26,000 comments within a few hours. That's what a columnist does. And he basically takes on, without having all the facts, because we were in that immediate conflict, he basically says, not only is it my job to have something to say, but you don't know what you just started. You thought we were weak, and you could break us. You've unified us.
Mm-hmm.
And he captures that righteous fury, which is a good thing to remember. That column is justly famous.
Yeah, it's a very important column. We're speaking this hour of the program with John Avlon. His book that he edited is Deadline Artists, America's Greatest Newspaper Columnists, and a dandy book it is. It's really fun to read these columns. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next call, Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. I certainly see the value to humor in columns. Earlier on, I heard a listener on a different station talking about supporting Newt Gingrich for president, and it occurred to me that in light of his moral deficiencies, that listener ignoring them was suffering from Gingrichitis, which is a dumb disease. So you can come up with humor, but on a parallel course also, there are a lot of serious writers that never get covered, it seems to me, in the American media, like Gore Vidal or Noam Chomsky or Michael Parenti, and some topics don't get touched either. The whole aspects of many aspects of 9/11 covered by Gore Vidal and Dreaming War, which are really quite profound to think about, and also the fact that the whole Iran-Contra thing was broken through Al Jazeera rather than the American press. So my concern is that sometimes really serious and worthwhile commentators don't get much coverage in the American press, if any at all.
Well, I understand where you're coming from. I do think that, I mean, certainly Noam Chomsky and Gore Vidal do get a lot of attention. They certainly come from a specific ideological perspective, and among those who share that perspective, they're quite renowned. I'd say that they're not newspaper columnists per se, so they were not in contention to be in the book. But I.F. Stone is in the book, someone who I think is a serious thinker and certainly of that same persuasion, and many others. I think it's important to hear all sides and judge people on the. In this book, our criteria was really simple. There wasn't ideological criteria. There wasn't a partisan criteria at all, because I think it's part of the problem in our press right now. Instead, our criteria was just great writing. Great writing whose power endured outside a specific news cycle.
And that's what we were focused on, and that's why I think it makes great reading. This is not an academic book. It's not a history of the newspaper column. We want this to be great reading for the general reader.
I grew up in Chicago, and it was a town of columnists. My mom actually was a, bless her heart, was a columnist for the Daily. We lived in Des Plaines, and then we lived in Elk Grove, and she did sort of the neighborhood gossip column, Dialing Elk Grove, Dialing Des Plaines. And, of course, we were figured prominently in the first paragraph of all of those columns. Why anybody even cared, I don't know, but it was wonderful. She was just a sweetheart and was a heck of a writer, you know, if she'd been able to go beyond what everybody's vacations were and who was born and who was at the party, and she did it splendidly. But she loved columns, and she'd send them to me all the time because she was a columnist of a sort. And Mike Royko, of course, was the guy in Chicago. Sidney Harris was another famous columnist in Chicago. And Royko had that, can we talk about kind of local columns? Who was, you were talking to a guy at the neighborhood coffee shop who was really smart, or you were at a bar having a beer and Mike Royko was sitting next to you and he was the person you wanted to talk to because what he had to say about what was going on.
Man, I'm so glad you brought up Royko because, you know, if there's a top tier, classic quintessential American newspaper columnist, I think you've got to put Royko and Breslin at that top.
Yeah,
they sort of became that. They really willed themselves into becoming kind of the platonic ideal of the American newspaper columnist. And it's because both of them, neither of them really wrote for broadsheets or, you know, they weren't writing for the New York Times or the Washington Post. They wrote for tabloids. They were talking to daily folks, everyday Chicagoans and New Yorkers, and they were blisteringly smart and really funny, and they could hit any pitch. They could write sports, politics, humor, crime, civil rights, and they did it with a clear sense of voice and a real emphasis on storytelling. And the local columnists are in many ways and many times the best. I do think that, you know, as newspapers try to figure out their continued relevance right now, I think what's clear is that the decision a few decades ago to water down local coverage in favor of sort of a genericizing, overusing wire copy.
I agree.
Killed the uniqueness of newspapers. It killed the uniqueness of local papers. And local news, you know, we can get information, usually national, international information, at the press of a button. What there's an incredible demand for, and you're starting to see it in what's called hyper-local local blogs, is local information and those local characters that people become really interested in. It helps create their sense of place, and nobody did it better than Mike Royko. One of my favorite columns in the book is Mike Royko writing right in the hours after the death of Richard Daley, who had been his longtime nemesis.
Yes, yes, he was.
And it was, and they had fought for decades, and probably were the two leading voices at the time. Here's the lead. I'll just read it.
Please.
Deadline artistry, if there ever was him. If a man ever reflected a city, it was Richard Day Daley of Chicago. In some ways, he was this town at its best. Strong, hard-driving, working feverishly, pushing, building, driven by ambitions so big they seemed Texas so boastful. But in other ways, he was a city at its worst. Arrogant, crude, conniving, ruthless, suspicious, intolerant. He wasn't graceful, suave, witty, or smooth. But then, this is not Paris or San Francisco. He was raucous, sentimental, hot-tempered, practical, simple, devious, big, and powerful. This is, after all, Chicago.
Oh, that's good.
So
and
good.
That is Chicago. There it is, yeah. Oh, yeah. Jim, thanks so much for the call. Robert on the road. Hi, Robert.
Yeah, thank you for being on. I just got in Northern Michigan. I liked the writer. I get his book, if he as George Will. He wrote a nice one about baseball, but I'm calling about a local guy, that an editor in a small paper. Just what he just said, I hate to repeat. He was hated by the right, hated by the left, and he was just a good columnist, and he was a World War II pilot, but yet he wrote both sides, and what I found interesting about the guy is that he made you think. I guess the thing that I enjoyed about papers, I don't know how to use a computer, but what I like about papers, and it's just even small papers, that it makes you think. If you can get thinking, then you'll be able to think about the other side. And what I liked about Duff is that he was against this, or at least he made a point about 18-year-old drinking in Wisconsin at the time, and in Minnesota was 21. So the bars had Duff days. His name was Phil Duff. Well, he's a character. He swims across the Mississippi, goes there, and he gets into the party. But they're sort of crucifying this editor. So he was a character, and you could call him up and have a debate with him. And I miss that. I miss the local editor that makes you think. Mm-hmm. And I think that we lost something in our country when everybody monkeys with the computers. Not that they're bad. I'm not that prehistoric. I don't know how to use one. But I miss the papers. Sometimes I'd fold it up, throw it down, go over to his house, knock on the door, sit in the back, have a beer, and start arguing about it. But you left with a different perspective. And I think as Americans, we miss it. I agree with the writer. I never met him. But what he just got done saying is that I'm one of the guys that miss it.
Yeah, John.
Yeah, I appreciate it. You know, one of the things the caller just said is that, you know, he liked it when a guy got flack from the left and the right. Usually meant he was doing something right, you know, doing something good. You know, if the far left and the far right are both attacking you and you're a columnist, it means you're trying to be independent. You're not kind of doing this pile-on. And that local sense of perspective with a sense of humor, people do miss that, and they want it. And there's going to continue to be demand. You know, look, form changes, but content remains the same. And there's going to be a demand for these kind of vivid personalities that have integrity and credibility and a sense of humor about themselves and the world. That'll be eternal. I think that'll last as long as we're human beings. I mean, he's calling from Upper Michigan right now, and one of my very favorite writers of any genre is Jim Harrison. Jim Harrison doesn't write newspaper columns. He writes, you know, essays and poetry and novels and novellas especially. But Harrison would have been a great newspaper columnist because of his great his earthiness and his intensity and his honesty and his sense of humor and his appreciation for the world around him and his lack of an ability to suffer fools gladly.
Yeah. Robert, thanks for the call. Polly in Two Rivers. Hi, Polly.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Polly.
You mentioned Leonard Pitts. He happens to be my favorite columnist, and the column that really struck me was that he encouraged Sarah Palin to run for office in 2012, and his last line was, run, Sarah, run. And what he actually was doing was making comment on her Barack Obama dumbing down his education and making fun of his ability to speak. I copied that article. I wrote to Leonard Pitts. He had so many hits on his email that he couldn't respond to everybody. But that was the one column to me that really struck me as, boy, he's really great, and he's now my favorite. And I enjoy reading him when he's in the daily newspaper.
Hmm.
That's great.
Yeah. Thank you, Polly, so much for your call. Judy in Milwaukee. Hi, Judy.
Hello. I'm a longtime New York City person who lives in Milwaukee now. And from the time I was little, when my parents subscribed to tons of newspapers, and later on when I realized we read the New York Post, the New York Times, Village Voice, New York Newsday, I wonder how I ever got out of the house. But the thing I enjoyed about many columnists was finding an interesting character and describing their story to illustrate a truism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was true of Breslin and Hamill and Newfield, certainly, and now Maureen Dowd, and certainly Crystal. And I wonder if that's characteristic of many of the columnists you write about.
It should be. I mean, it is. I mean, I think that is a characteristic that the great ones have. And the folks you mentioned, I think, are without a fail in the book. You touch on, and I think the previous caller spoke to as well, it's a reminder of how, and it's a reminder for editors today as well, that newspaper columnists, it's really the soul of the paper, right? There are lots of places you can get stats and facts.
Mm-hmm.
But newspaper columnists are the soul of a paper, and they're the folks who can cut through all the spin, which we have more of today than ever before, and tell you, try to get to the truth beneath it. Try to keep things in a human dimension, because at the end of the day, that's in the level of what we all live. Whether you're president of the United States or whether you're a truck driver in Milwaukee, you know, we keep that perspective on our problems, and to give us a sense of perspective on our current events, that's the important role here. It's the soul of a paper. Mm-hmm. That's why people love columnists so much.
Yeah, it's a good description. Thanks, Judy. Dave in Grand Chute. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Another Royko story. I actually cut this out when I lived down there about 35 years ago. Royko had written a column about Budweiser and Schlitz, which were the two best-selling beers, and said that they tasted like they went in one end of the horse and came out the other. And he got so many nasty phone calls about this that he got a bunch of his blue-collar beer-drinking friends together and did a blindfold test of 30 beers. And Budweiser and Schlitz came in number 27 and 29, respectively. Number four, I remember, was Point Special from right here in Stevens Point.
Hey.
Well, you know, Royko knew of where he spoke in there. And Breslin used to do beer ads. I found him the other day. We put him on our Facebook page for the book. Peels. It's a good drinking beer. It was a great, you know, these guys did ads for beer. They were that iconic. And just in case you had too much of a good thing, one of a great column in the book in the humor section is Mike Royko on how to cure a hangover. So he made sure he covered his readers on both ends of that spectrum as well.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm so glad you did this book. It's just, and it's one of those books you can read it before you go to sleep. You don't want to get involved in a really long thing, but you want something meaningful to read. It's got some meat to it, and you think about it, and you're reading great literature, and it's just, I'm so glad you did it. It's just,
Thank you.
It's really very well done. So on to volume two, John.
I really appreciate it. It's been a lot of fun talking to you and taking calls from listeners. And thank you for appreciating Deadline Artists as much as you do.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thanks for being with us. John Avlon, one of the editors of Deadline Artists, America's greatest newspaper columns. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. And thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody. It's always great to hear from you. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Talking about compelling topics, meaningful topics with interesting guests, and there are great hours of conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.